Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We have appreciated for a long time now the intelligence of Matthew Brodsky when it comes particularly to matters involving the Middle East, subject matter on which he has specialized for many years in a variety of incarnations. These days he's with the Strategic Studies Group. He is in the past worked for the Jewish Policy Center, the American Foreign Policy Council, and been an editorial assistant with the Israeli publication Haaretz, among other distinctions. We're delighted to have him back. Matt, welcome. Thank you so much for taking a few minutes.
Good to be with you.
Well, where to begin in your portfolio? I guess the obvious place is what you made of President Trump's announcement earlier this week about the Iran deal. And where we should go from here?
Well, I think it was a very important decision. Clearly, he was leaning toward it for a long period of time. The most important thing that it does is not, I should say that in addition to dealing with the nuclear problem much more effectively by getting rid of the deal, it allows the United States to really refocus our Middle Eastern policy in general, which has under the Obama administration and as a result of this deal, had been tied into keeping our relationship with Iran on a very positive footing to the extent possible and essentially throwing our allies under the bus. So this is a very good move that allows us to begin pushing back on the greatest strategic threat facing the U.S., and that's Iran when it comes to the Middle East.
Do you credit the statements that have been made by the president and some of his representatives that there will be new negotiations pursued? Or do you think that in point of fact, this is kind of the end of the road on all of that and that regime change is really the only way we're now going to be able to control the threat posed by Iran, both nuclear and in other forms?
First of all, the regime is obviously horrible in Tehran, and the best way to ensure that they don't have a nuclear weapon would be through a regime that is responsible to the people and is far better and not ideologically driven as they are. I don't think that means U.S. boots on the ground or active military measures to make something like that happen. But to the extent that we can encourage and work on the side of the people, again, like we did not do under the Obama administration, to work with the people who have been on the streets and demanding changes, who are aware that all the goodies that the regime received from the nuclear deal all has gone to the foreign adventures, such as in Syria, as opposed to helping the average Iranian. That's a very important thing to happen. Now, as far as new negotiations are concerned, America's problem right now, even before it would get to Iran, if such renegotiations were to continue, would be convincing Europe. We need to get leverage with Europe first, who basically sees the deal as a means to make a lot of money. So we can engage in renegotiation and trying to come up with something for Europe, but a really good policy, the plan B that everyone thinks doesn't exist, is really to leave a horrible deal behind, get back to a place where we have maximum leverage with sanctions, and give Iran the choice. You move forward, bad things are going to happen, you know?
Well, I think getting back to a point where we have leverage and that we are actually working to help undermine the regime is very much the name of the game at the moment, not new negotiations that would have the effect, I'm afraid, of propping them up once again. But let me ask you, Matt Brodsky, about one of the other major areas of concern about Iran at the moment, of course, and that is the intensifying prospect of conflict between Israel and Iran over the latter's movement into Syria in force and increasingly not just the capacity to threaten Israel, but the use of rockets and missiles, I guess, from Syria in recent days to attack Israel. Do you anticipate that we're heading into potentially a regional conflict between these two parties, initially at least?
It could very well happen. But in the meantime, Israel has three options when it looks at Iran. It can trust in Russia to look over its security concerns. It can continue its tit-for-tat type of strikes, which it has been doing, specifically looking at what it's taken out at the T4 base, a major logistical airport where Iran flies in weapons and SAM systems into Syria. Or it can have a really comprehensive campaign to utterly destroy Iran's position inside of Syria. Now, Israel chose a day ago or so to have a 2.5 type of option, which is to really comprehensive go after all of Iran's position, but to still pull back. The way this spreads regionally is if one of the two parties decides to involve Lebanon and Hezbollah there. In the meantime, it looks very much like we'll see if Iran has learned a lesson from the really strong response that Israel had inside of Syria. If it does, then we might be back where we were. If not, this escalates further and Israel will still try to destroy Iran further inside of Syria. The main question is, from Israel's perspective, can they accomplish all of their objectives if there are missile or arms manufacturing facilities that are existing underground in Lebanon, in which case they're going to have to find a way to take care of that. But yes, Iran is equally determined to set up shop on Israel's doorstep and to pose a threat right there, and Israel's equally determined to stop it.
And of course, you're right to point to the threat posed by Hezbollah in Lebanon. The size of its missile force now in place and apparently ready to go, capable of ranging the entirety of Israel, is of grave concern, I know, to the Israelis, and I think to all of those of us who, you know, stand with her. Speaking of standing with Israel, Matt, next week we will have the United States Embassy move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a signal and long overdue and I think very important accomplishment of the Trump administration. What do you anticipate is going to be the response from the Palestinians and perhaps others to that development?
Well, in speaking to people in the Israeli Defense Forces, what they're seeing as far as this Gaza March protest is that, of course, this is on Fridays for going now for several weeks. They have large protests in Gaza, which are actually designed by Hamas to hide terrorists, to rush the fence and to get into Israel. Now, the participation has gone down each week, and it's supposed to come to a crescendo in the next week when it's Nakba Day, the disaster as far as the Palestinian narrative is concerned. So while the participation has gone down, the violence level has gone up. In other words, a lot more terrorists are obviously at the forefront right there. So they're not going to enjoy this, but really it's something that the Israeli Defense Forces are quite capable and ready to deal with. It is a great move to move the embassy. And like the president has said, everyone's promised it. No one's ever delivered on it. And that's just ridiculous.
Matt Brodsky, we're always grateful to you for taking some time to talk with us. We'll look forward to our further visits with you soon. In the meantime, have a good weekend, my friend. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Gertz about, the Iran deal, a little bit more from his perspective, and China, that and more, straight after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's a pleasure to say we have the privilege of being escorted around the ring by our duty expert on what happens inside the Pentagon, Bill Gertz, an investigative reporter par excellence. He writes a prize-winning column, Inside the Ring, for the Washington Times. He is the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon. He is also the author of seven, count them, seven best-selling books, including most recently I, War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, there's a lot to talk with you about, my friend, so let's move quickly through this if we can. Iran, we had this week the president deciding he was not going to perpetuate the what I call Obama bomb deal. Tell us your thoughts on that, if you would, please, particularly against the backdrop of some testimony by Secretary of Defense Mattis that there are five, count them, five different threats posed to us by the Iranians at the moment. Is this something we can afford to ignore?
No, it's a good thing that the president pulled out of the Iran deal. I mean, it was clearly, I had a piece this week that revealed that the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, had, contrary to the most of the intelligence community and every place else, he revealed that the Iranians were, in fact, not in compliance with the nuclear deal. So, and that was just one reason that they pulled out of it. But it was, one of these intelligence biases that they were trying to do everything possible to keep the Iran deal, and they got out of it. Mattis testified before the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee and talked about Iran's malign activities, and they include its support for terrorism. It's the largest sponsor of state terrorism, its ballistic missile development, its cyber attacks, its threats on international commerce in the Red Sea, and as well as its nuclear weapons program. So those were the five areas that he outlined.
And worrisome in every respect. Bill, you've also been reporting about China, which is, of course, a very prominent concern of this program. Talk a little bit about some of the advanced arms that are now coming on stream in the Chinese military. The Congressional Commission on Economic and Security Review Commission is at it again, trying to raise an alarm. Tell us what they found.
Yeah, this is an important story. It's a major report came out just this week, which outlined five advanced Chinese weapons program. And the way I described it in a tweet today was that this is the real great leap forward. Mao's great leap was a disaster in trying to modernize the country, and millions died. But this is a military great leap forward by the Chinese, which are seeking to develop advanced weaponry. And at the top of the list is space warfare weapons, including direct ascent missiles that can shoot down satellites, also a on-orbit killer satellites, lasers, beam weapons, and cyber attacks on satellites. So this is a real Achilles heel for the U.S. military. We're very reliant on our satellite and space sensors and navigation and guidance and intelligence, and they're building up their forces to be able to take out those satellites in a conflict, which could cripple the U.S. military. Military is taking steps to harden the satellites, but it is a major concern. The other areas that they're working on are drones underwater, in the air, on ground, and combined with artificial intelligence. So there's really this big push to develop weapons that can basically think for themselves and operate at incredibly fast speeds without a human in the loop. So this is the direction that the Chinese are going.
And Bill Gertz, we're hearing that swarming of these drones is a feature that they're building into them, which makes them that much more difficult to intercept, does it not? And to the extent that these things are in the works, do we have a sense, and maybe you can't generalize, Bill, but do we have a sense of how fast we're likely to see them actually deployed in the arsenals of the Chinese military?
Yeah, the report, which was done, again, for the U.S.-China Economic Security and Review Commission, was also done by a contractor, the Jane's Defense, which had a bunch of analysts look at it. And they said that this stuff is coming online in a decade or less. And we're talking also about hypersonic missiles, maneuvering warheads, against which we have no defense right now and urgently need to develop defenses against.
Let me ask you, Bill, you mentioned the intelligence problem in all of this. You also reported on the arrest of a China, or the indictment, I should say, of a Chinese American by the name of Jerry Chun Xing Li. Tell us his story and what it portends for our intelligence capabilities vis-a-vis China.
Yeah, this is a story that got lost in the news cycle earlier this week. The Eastern District of Virginia federal indictment against this former CIA officer who was working in Hong Kong and basically was recruited by Chinese intelligence. And the indictment didn't specify it, but they made clear that he had improperly stored the names and identities of recruited CIA agents in China. So this is an intelligence disaster for the CIA at a time when the Trump administration urgently needs inside intelligence on what's going on in China. Just probably 8 or 10 years ago, all of the agents there appeared to have been compromised by this spy case, which is just beginning to unfold with this indictment this week.
So this would be a body blow to our human intelligence capabilities vis-a-vis China, which I have to tell you, Bill, is something that's concerned me about the nomination of Gina Haspel to be the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. I understand that she was very much involved with John Brennan, the Obama director of the Central Intelligence Agency, in so-called modernizing of our human intelligence programs and capabilities, which was a misleading term for the dismantling of many of them. Do you have concerns on this score as well, Bill? And would they be exacerbated, if so, by what you've just shared with us about these Chinese counterintelligence successes?
Yes, it's a huge problem. I was very disappointed that at the hearing this week in the Senate Intelligence Committee for Gina Haspel, the CIA director nominee, there were no questions about quality controls and counterintelligence. It was all enhanced interrogation. And there seemed even her advanced policy questions, which usually address a range of issues like intelligence collection and counterintelligence, there was nothing. It was all about her past role in operating a CIA black site in Thailand. And again, the CIA urgently needs to be reformed. Their quality is way down. We're spending huge amounts of money. During the war on terrorism, the CIA got away from its main mission of stealing secrets and got into the business of drone strikes, which was effective in stopping terrorist leaders, but spawned the ISIS offshoot of Al-Qaeda. And so, there's really an urgent need to reform U.S. intelligence, starting with CIA. I'm not sure that Gina Haspel is going to be able to do that, but she's likely to be confirmed. It could be a close vote. The Democrats are going to flood her with additional questions in order to slow roll the nomination process. I think that'll be the next step.
Yeah, we'll be watching it closely, Bill. You do, too, these matters, and in particular, this issue of the quality of our counterintelligence is so troubling. It seems as though it's not just being neglected by members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, at least in that hearing, but more generally by our intelligence, overseers and organizations. Bill, let me ask you about one other item. The president has now announced that there will be a meeting with Kim Jong-un, the dictator of North Korea, in Singapore on June 12th. We've had, of course, this week the release of three people that he had taken hostage. This has been seen as a precursor to a successful meeting. Give us your reading and what you're picking up in terms of the sense inside the building, the Pentagon, that is, about this meeting and its prospects.
Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said he's cautiously optimistic based on the signals and signs coming from North Korea. I'm very skeptical as an expert observer of the North Koreans that what it seems to me that Kim Jong-un is trying to do is to legitimate his access to nuclear weapons. I think it's going just in the opposite direction that everyone thinks it's going. Well, Kim has been making noises about denuclearizing. I think this whole setup is going to be that Kim will try to be recognized as having North Korea recognized as a nuclear power. And I don't think that's going to happen. So I'm hopeful that if something like that should play out, that the president will be willing to walk away from those talks in Singapore.
He said as much. The trouble is, as these things get closer, we've both seen a lot of these sort of diplomatic dances. It becomes more and more important. And I think actually this president has spoken to this. He's really looking for a success here. And once you're invested that much in it, it becomes extremely difficult to say we will walk away. We'll see. Hey, Bill, one other thing. I mentioned written a terrific book on information warfare, and you had a piece in, I believe it was The Beacon this week, about the Orwellian disinformation that the Chinese are pushing out, and that they're insisting that U.S. carriers, that is to say airlines and the like, conform to. Tell us a little bit about that and an insight that it provides into the degree to which our adversaries are using information warfare very aggressively.
Yeah, this is a really positive reaction from the White House. Unfortunately, they did it on a Saturday, last Saturday, issuing a statement denouncing Chinese political correctness or the attempts to impose political correctness on Americans and American companies. And this was in the case of trying to describe Taiwan on their websites and on their handheld apps in ways that would conform with Beijing's view of Taiwan being a breakaway province. And they said that it was Orwellian to try and do this, which was really good. This was Sarah Sanders, the White House press secretary, doing this. So I was very encouraged by that.
Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Thank you for this quick tour de raison of the various fields that you cover so well. Thank you for joining us today. Next up, we will speak with Daniel Horowitz right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, as I am thrilled to say, we have the privilege of being from time to time by Daniel Horowitz, one of the brightest and most articulate and certainly most energetic of a new generation of thoughtful conservatives that I've had the privilege to know and work with. Daniel is these days with the Conservative Review. He writes a really important column entitled The Conservative Consciousness with Daniel Horowitz. He has formerly been with the Madison Project. He has contributed massively to a variety of great platforms, including Red State and Breitbart and The Blaze. He is also the author of a stupendously important book, Stolen Sovereignty: How to Stop Unelected Judges from Transforming America. Daniel Horowitz, it's so good to have you. Welcome back.
Great to be back with you, Frank.
Well, you've been firing for effect in a number of different directions. Let me start with a topic that is controversial, shall we say, within conservative and Republican circles. And yet there seems to be increasingly a move in the direction of embracing it. And that is something that has been broadly defined as criminal justice reform, piece of which recently was approved with, I believe, 25 out of 30 members of the Republican side of the House Judiciary Committee supporting it. Tell us from your perspective, Daniel Horowitz, what's going on there and its implications?
Well, there's been a general trend over the last really 5 to 10 years where everyone, all the moneyed interests on both sides are pushing a decriminalization agenda, weaker police tactics, lesser sentences, jailbreak, these retroactive releases. The problem is this movement is built on a lie. Lie number one is that there's too many people in prison. Well, the prison population per capita is now lower than at any moment, really any year since 1996. So we've reversed a lot of the gains. And incidentally, crime is going up. According to 2015-2016 FBI data, in most parts of the country, we experienced an uptick in violent crime. The reality is you can't have South Africa levels of crime and Japanese levels of incarceration. That is just a reality. The goal is to deal with crime, the goal is public safety. You have to look at everything in a balanced way. Instead, there's this one-sided myopic zero-sum game of sympathy for the criminals. And rather than taking a very judicious look at different things we can do, both to toughen laws and then maybe also leniencies where appropriate, it's just this jailbreak agenda. So you referenced the House Judiciary Committee. They just passed a bill that will allow a future Democrat attorney general, but certainly even the current attorney general, to cut prison terms by one third for these retroactive time credit served programs. The problem is they have there's no judicious approach to this. Across the board, it applies to almost everyone, including not just cocaine traffickers, but heroin and fentanyl traffickers that are now killing or responsible for the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans. This bill requires that retroactively the Bureau of Prisons must relocate everyone to within 500 miles of where they live. So you now have 22,000 gang members that are going to have to be transported to different facilities. And there's no supermax facilities within 500 miles of a lot of states. So what I hear is people like El Chapo and the Boston bomber will have to be moved to possibly a lower level security facility. There are numerous problems with this piece of legislation, but like I said, it's a broader philosophical problem that's driving it. And you know, Frank, just like with the immigration cartel, which is very much overlaps with the criminal justice movement, it is all about more votes.
Is it the belief of Republicans, though, that have thrown in with this effort, Daniel Horowitz, that there will be more votes for Republicans if they allow more felons to vote?
Well, I guess the same likelihood that there will be more votes for Republicans if they enact amnesty for illegal aliens. I don't understand it. Philosophically, they're only hearing from the jailbreak side. They're not hearing the other side of the story. They're being fed erroneous data, erroneous premises. And then also, you know, it's just very enticing because they couch it as a limited government endeavor. Well, we're going to cut funding for prisons. We're going to save money. We're wasting money on incarceration. Well, I wish we didn't have to do it, but the cost of property crimes and the cost of violent crime to this country, not just in terms of security, but in terms of the fiscal cost, dwarfs the cost of incarceration. But again, we're looking at this one-dimensionally in a myopic approach.
Let me ask you about something you sort of alluded to there a moment ago, and that is the effort to facilitate more people coming into this country. The caravan that Donald Trump called attention to a few weeks ago has, of course, arrived at the border with the United States, northern border for Mexico, southern border for this country. And a number of the people in it have now been processed. And you report that they've actually been admitted into the country and are now being released here, which I thought wasn't Donald Trump's idea and certainly wasn't what he ran on. And that raises the question of whether this is going to serve as a tremendous magnet for still more people to do precisely the same thing in caravans or otherwise.
You know, until Iran obtains nuclear weapons, this remains our biggest vulnerability. This is the biggest security problem. This whole DACA agenda, the magnet and incentive that has been telegraphed to the world, that if you come here either as a teenager, which among many of them are gang members, by the way, or if you come as a family unit with children, you're pretty much here to stay. We're going to allow you to be processed on our shores instead of in the Mexico City embassy, which that is actually how it should be done. And then we're going to release you pending the outcome of your trial, which, as you well know, a lot of them abscond and never show up. They disappear into our population. That is why we are now seeing, after the initial Trump effect of the trickling of migration, we're now seeing a surge up to 2015 levels, 50,000 per month. And those are just the people we catch. You can imagine the people we do not catch. And what is so disturbing about the caravan is that even those of us who are pessimistic figured this is such a blatant challenge to our sovereignty. It's an invasion. It's political. It's not even a bogus asylum endeavor. It's just purely political. They wouldn't let them in. Indeed, the 228 remaining people who made it to our border have been let in. A lot of them have been processed, and at least according to some reports, some of them have been released pending the date of their hearing. And that is a very big problem because the drug cartels are watching this very carefully. Remember, the drug cartels don't just smuggle in drugs. They control all the human smuggling routes. And that is in part how they get in a lot of their drugs. A lot of these people are drug mules or they serve as diversions for the high value targets, as a lot of border agents will tell you. The real danger here to our national security is there's been an uptick along with this atmosphere we've created for this dreamer, asylum, unaccompanied alien child, refugee status are Middle Easterners. A record number of Syrians and Bangladeshis are crossing in the Laredo sector in central Texas. Laredo is controlled on the Mexican side by the Los Zetas cartel. Zetas is the cartel with the most established ties to Hezbollah. They both work together with the cocaine trade in South America. And you better believe that Hezbollah is involved in moving those people in because they come from Bangladesh or Syria and they fly out of Lebanon and are serviced with all sorts of false documentation by Hezbollah. They fly to Brazil where Hezbollah has a huge base of operations and they come north. And finally, Frank, you know what the biggest threat to our country is? A living Syria dynamic in more ways than one in the Western Hemisphere is Venezuela. Venezuela is collapsing. There's hundreds of thousands of refugees, and there are signs that they're going to come north, and they're certainly going to come north now that we've incentivized it. Guess what? Not only do you have the bogus asylum seekers, the fiscal drain, MS-13 drugs and gangs, but Venezuela is the country with hundreds of thousands of Lebanese and Syrian diaspora, along with, you know, Hezbollah and Iranian relationships at the highest level. So you better believe that is the vulnerability that Iran will exploit.
Yeah. Daniel Horowitz, one other aspect of this, which I think you have rightly said is very much a part of the threat posed to this country by Iran, wasn't on the list of places that Bill Gertz alluded to in connection with Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis's characterization of the five threats Iran poses to us. But there are Hezbollah cells inside the United States as well, and they are active, and we're told a direction from Tehran could be operationalized to go after targets inside this country. How high a priority do you think we need to apply to neutralizing that threat?
I think it's a bigger priority than Afghanistan, Yemen, Somalia, Syria, Iraq, and anything in the Middle East. This is, again, it's the nexus of the drug crisis, the migration crisis, and terrorism where they could actually hit us. I say this a lot, and I know I disagree with some colleagues. Some of these Sunni countries that are just ravaged with civil wars, they cannot really affect us unless we let them in. Here, they have a base of operation to come seamlessly through the drug cartels into our border. As you noted, they already have cells in this country through the Lebanese Shiite community. A lot of contraband networks with money laundering, used car businesses. There have been several people that have been arrested in connection with both the Zetas drug cartel and Hezbollah. And just a couple months ago, Politico had a bombshell report that Obama, in order to grease the skid for the Iran deal, shut off what was known as Operation Cassandra to organize this coordinated cross-governmental effort to combat Hezbollah south of our border. Thankfully, DOJ has reinstated a task force. It's unclear how much they're focusing on and how many resources they're pouring into it. But I would say we need our military, we need all our statecraft tools diplomatically to work with our allies such as Argentinian government, Peru, Guatemala, Panama, and isolate the problematic governments in Venezuela, Bolivia, Ecuador.
Daniel, so much more to talk about. We are hard out of time. Thank you for your visit with us today and for the terrific work you do at Conservative Review. Next up, we will be speaking with David Goldman. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are pleased to say we are once again joined by David Goldman, one of the really brilliant intellects and analysts of our times. He writes under the nom de guerre, I think of it as Spengler, at Asia Times. He is a managing director of Reorient Group Limited. And a man of many parts, particularly with some distinguished experience and background in economics, which he brings to bear on the geostrategic issues of our day. Welcome back, David. It's so good to have you.
Frank, it's always an honor. Thanks.
Well, good. Let's start with a piece that you had recently, David, about the idea of buying Russian rubles at the moment, but selling Turkish lira. I'm told this is not just good strategic advice, but that it's actually good financial advice as well. Tell us what was motivating your counsel.
Well, I think that the spat between Russia and the United States is going to blow over, and that there will be an eventual rapprochement between Trump and Putin. The fact that Putin hosted Netanyahu so prominently in Moscow a couple of days ago during the victory parade is a very good sign. Very simply, if you look at the relationship between oil and the Russian ruble is essentially a proxy for oil. Ruble is now around 62 to the dollar. Based on where the oil price is, it should be closer to 50. So I think there is 20% upside in the ruble just as it reverts the normal relationship. Now, Turkey is a different matter. Turkey is a typical third world kleptocracy run by a corrupt dictator with a bunch of corrupt cronies around him who have exploited the country to enrich themselves and gotten the banking system to put out huge amounts of credit, borrowed up to their eyeballs. And we have the kind of typical situation like in Latin America, where at some point the reckoning comes and they can't keep borrowing and the currency collapses and the people are basically lose their savings. So I think that's what we're seeing in Turkey.
Yeah, let me ask you about two pieces of this then. The price of oil seems to be going up. That will presumably be good news for Putin. And your suggestion that it may be, you know, an environment in which there can be a rapprochement between him and the United States seems to me to be belied by a lot of his behavior that isn't just a spat. It would seem to me to be sort of animated by strategic motivations. And as just to quickly to put both on the table, as to the kleptocracy, it's really ironic, isn't it, that Erdogan, I think, sort of made his initial claim to fame on the grounds that he was going to be incorruptible because of his adherence to the Sharia tenets of Islam. If you could, just a word on both of those.
Oil is good for Putin. Oil is bad for Turkey because Russia exports it and Turkey imports it. Turkey is importing about the equivalent of 6% of its GDP in money per year to finance its trade deficit. They can't do that forever. That's what we were doing before the financial crisis in 2008. As a standard of comparison. But if you look at the last 48 hours, President Trump withdraws from the Iran deal, which I applaud. The Iranians test the resolve of the Israelis. The Israelis attack Iranian installations in Iran. They tell the Russians in advance. They chop up Syria's air defense. And then, just about an hour ago, the Russians announced they're not going to sell any more air defense missiles to the Syrians, no S-300, no anything. So it looks like Putin is playing ball with the Israelis, trying to keep the Iranians on a leash because they've got some influence, and being very helpful to President Trump, contrary to all the hysterics who said this would lead to a confrontation in the Middle East. It appears the Russians are doing everything possible to avoid a confrontation and clipping the wings of the Iranians.
And how about Erdogan and his agenda? What do we make of the lies that apparently have been used to sell the Turkish people on his ascendancy?
Typical third world buying an election tactic. You put out huge amounts of credit and you get temporary growth and a big increase in consumption, but also huge increases in debt. So Turkey is drowning in foreign currency debt. They've got to borrow to pay the interest. Foreign creditors are getting much less comfortable with their situation. So the currency has lost about half its value in the past 3 years. And that's raised the cost of debt service. They're getting into a vicious spiral where every time the currency falls, their cost of debt service goes up. They have to borrow more. the creditors get more and more uncomfortable and the currency keeps going down. That's how you get that kind of third world currency spiral.
Mm-hmm. And so we're likely to see this election coming up in Turkey reflect this kind of bait and switch to the benefit of Erdogan, or do you think the Turks are getting wise to what's going on?
Well, the problem is Erdogan has put huge numbers of opposition politicians and journalists in jail. He's running a reign of terror against opponents. No one, none of the prominent politicians are willing to run against him. So he very well may win the elections simply because he's effectively running a dictatorship. But the price will be paid by the Turkish people, who will become poorer as a result.
We're following closely his aspirations for the new caliphate, and this will be an important milestone, I suppose, on the way. We'll look forward to talking with you about it further. Let me switch gears with you, if I can, David. You've been writing about the U.S.-China trade talks and the prospect of a trade war and what that's doing to China's currency and more. Talk, if you would, about the role of a man I've known for a bit and have frankly admired, Peter Navarro, in all of this, and more generally, where you think things stand.
I don't quite understand what American trade policy is towards China. The delegation, including Navarro and Ross and Mnuchin and Kudlow, went to Beijing a week and a half ago and told the Chinese, we want a $200 billion cut in the trade deficit, and we want you to stop subsidizing your high value-added industries, neither of which the Chinese would or possibly could accept. There's no way to reduce the U.S. trade deficit by $200 billion by 2020, as the delegation indicated. So it's not clear to me what they want. The problem is, now that we've cut off chip sales to China's number two telecom equipment company, ZTE, and ZTE is effectively simply shut down, the number one company, that's Huawei, biggest telecom equipment company in the world, has an unlimited budget from the Chinese government for a crash program to replace all the chips that they buy from Qualcomm and other American companies and produce them in China. They're already producing some. So the result of our attempts to beat up the Chinese for their misbehavior by cutting off chip sales is going to give a giant push towards a Chinese domestic chip industry to replace their imports from us. That's shooting ourselves in the foot. What we need to be doing is investing in technologies the Chinese don't have and can't get so easily and leapfrog them. Because right now, we're looking at the Chinese going up the value-added chain to compete with us. And if we put tariffs on the stuff they sell to us, they sell us low value added goods. They sell us assembled computers and smartphones. They sell us toasters and washing machines and so forth. We're not going to assemble smartphones here. We're not going to assemble computers. We'll buy them from Vietnam instead of China, basically the same components and a different label. So we don't win in a trade war. At best, it's a split decision, and the Chinese end up moving up the value added chain.
Let me ask you to play this out, David Goldman. I know we've talked about this on previous shows, and you've alluded to it now, too, the idea of leapfrogging and developing chip technologies that essentially assure the dominant position of the United States going forward, though I presume the same reasons that are currently, I think, properly causing us to say, hey, we don't want to facilitate the success of these Chinese companies, Huawei and ZTE, both for that matter, in penetrating markets that are likely to result in the Chinese having capabilities to use those telecommunications devices for espionage or for other nefarious purposes. Wouldn't we not be interested in selling them a better chip just as much as we are the current generation?
Well, right now, we dominate the market for chip-making equipment. We still control 47% of production in chip-making equipment. It's very likely that in the next 10 years, new technologies are going to make it vastly more efficient to manufacture chips.
David Goldman, again, thank you for the work you do as Spengler at Asia Times. We'll talk with the rest of you again, I hope, on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.